So, good afternoon, everyone. It's not afternoon in the UK, but it is here. So, it's the beginning of the year, of a new year, which this is a concept because it's actually not, there's not new or old, but it helps us to organize things if we give ourselves a calendar and days and hours and give it names. You can't see on the screen, but my cat is participating. And at this time of year, sometimes we start anew. We start new projects. We think, oh, I should really do this. I should go back to that. And it's kind of the equivalent of with our mobile devices or our computers, if we reboot or we refresh or we return to the factory settings, as they say, you know, you wipe everything out and start over again. And this is a metaphor that works to a certain extent, because, like our devices, we become overloaded with so many things that we've added that we think would be interesting and or we think we need, and or we think, oh, this is a way to do something, and I'll try it, and then we don't ever look at it again, or we have an app that we think will be really helpful, and then we stock all kinds of music and film and all, you know, audio and video files, and then pretty soon it doesn't work anymore, our device. Or we get the virus, it becomes contaminated. And we become contaminated with a lot of what we interact with, exactly with our devices. We contaminate ourselves, or we are completely intoxicated by the intoxicating stimulus that is around us in our world. Also, the violent, toxic manifestations all around, whether it's political, economic, social, emotional, psychological. It can be in our family, it can be in our community, it can be in our city, it can be in our state, it can be in our country, our world, right? And we are so overloaded with it all. We're like, what do I do? What can I do? What should I do? And we become paralyzed. So the beginning of the year is a good moment to do the equivalent of like the reboot. Or what do they call that when you like return to the factory settings? I don't know what the verb is.
Réinitialiser, I was looking in
Right.
English, yeah.
Reinitial, yeah, you'd say in French. And but so what does that mean in terms of our being and our practice, right? Because Zen practice is actually totally useless. That's absolutely the beauty of it, is that it's useless. It useless in the sense of it's non-utilitarian. As soon as we start trying to make it useful or obtain something or arrive somewhere or seek a result, well, then we're going in the opposite direction. We're no longer just being here now with what is. Our liberation, which is our goal actually, to be free, involves being just here now with what is. So we're in this, you know, in English we call this a catch-22, where damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? So if you don't do anything, well, you'll just go on with your overloaded device. If you do do something, you are, oh, that door's not closed. You're just adding to the overload. So our choice is, what do we do then? Well, we do nothing. But what does do nothing really look like? And what does that mean, do nothing? Because we all decided today that we would do this, that we would come and sit and do this, which is very different than everything else we would have done today. We probably have our Sunday routines, or we have work that we need to do, or places we go, or people we see, or my living room, kitchen, house would not look at all like this today, if on a normal Sunday. So I chose to do something else in this space. We all did. So what are we doing exactly? That's the question, right?
J'allais dire pareil.
What are we doing? Or what are we not doing? We know what we're not doing in a global way, right? We know that we're not doing what we would otherwise have done. We know that we're not speaking. We know that we are not preparing all of the food for our meal together. We know that we are not eating what we normally would eat on this day. We know some things that we are not doing. We are not moving while we're sitting, although we can move, but generally we're not.
We're not talking.
We're not talking.
I talk all day long,
Right. So
personally.
that's part of, you know, the not talking, not speaking is it's a big one. But so then what we're doing is just what we're not doing. This is an interesting place that that brings us. So, and we know that in Zen, when we hear stories, when we read about it, and we, you know, all the great masters throughout the generations are always talking about not thinking, not doing, no effort. It's always no. It's always not. And there's a reason for that, right? Because as soon as we put, it's as if we don't have words for not doing. And we think automatically of when it's not, that then it's some kind of passive thing. But actually, this action that is not action, right? I noted something that I wanted to remember about that. This not doing is actually going towards and ultimately brings us to this acting without the identity center of me, of self. So it's like selfless action. Not selfless in the sense of I will sacrifice myself and I will, you know, put my coat down on the road so you can walk and not get muddy feet. But then I have a muddy coat. So it's not that kind of selflessness, right? It's not even having the identity center of self. Or, you know, so my cat has no idea of what is hers and not. So she wants to drink out of my glass. Right? Actually, she is, you know, very, she does try to mark the territory in with regards to the other cat, actually. So it's acting without this identity center of self, this attachment to self. And, or we can say it's acting with an empty and therefore wild mind. It's wild. So it's empty in the sense that it's not bound by should not, rules, positions, patterns, want, don't want. It returns to its original factory setting, right? Which is wild. And our Sangha is wildflower for that reason as well. It's these blossoming wildly when we are truly who we are. Truly where we are with whatever the situation is. So that's one aspect of our practice, is this non-acting. And we put the emphasis on this doing nothing, because that enables us to clear away and get rid of all the stuff we've added on, return to the factory setting. Return to the original face, the true self, the original mind, mu, all these things that we call it, you know. Your true self before your parents were born, we say, you know. And this doesn't make any sense. Logically, it doesn't make any sense. But that's exactly the point. The logic is what catches us and keeps us, it's a constraint. Of course, it's wonderful and serves us in the relative world where we need to have logical thought. But when we are returning to who we truly are and our essence, which will then, when we can truly experience that without the constraints, then we can freely move in the world of constraints and limits and logic. It really is simple and yet extremely difficult, because we're so conditioned by the constraints and the world of logic and the forms and who we think we should be and doing this or not doing that and all this. So this returning, coming back to that I'm talking about, which is the very essence of our practice. At this particular fraught, confusing, disturbing moment in which we live, our world as it is today, is really the most wonderful thing you can do for yourself, and also the most radical. Because the world as it is, you know, exploding with, you know, completely deluded behavior all around, and behavior that's deluded because it's focusing on the dualities and the separation rather than on the oneness, and focusing on consuming, obtaining, and separating. It's difficult to not become caught in that, because that is how we've been conditioned to function. And we don't know how to act in a way that doesn't behave in that same way. So, you know, we have these outrageous things where, you know, the president of the United States wants to buy a country. And if that country won't allow itself to be sold, it wants to take it over with its army, right? Which just, it's so outrageous that we don't even know how to react to that. The sending in an army to take over the country that you're a friend of sounds completely just beyond the pale, right? And it is, according to the usual way that we have thought of the world functioning. We have friends and enemies, and we take care of our friends and we attack our enemies. So this is even, doesn't even fit with our usual logical system. So our usual logic doesn't work and gives rise to a lot of fear and anxiety and disrupts And this is just one example, okay, but this is a pretty clear one. Disrupts our usual way of functioning, where we can just think of Greenland as being, okay, part of Europe, and the US is part of the US, and we're all participating in this, you know, NATO alliance, and we're all buddies. Well, we're not, apparently, you know. How do we react to that? And that's just one example. And all of the other examples we could give come from that same root of acting from a place of identity self. That's where all of that action comes from. So how can we react to that, or respond, or be with that? Because it's not so much react, but respond to and be with and function in a wholesome way in such a situation. Really hard to know. The solutions, so this is an example of, this is a koan, okay? We hear about koans in our tradition all the time. Koans being these stories, the word actually, you know, one of the translators, modern translators, David, I can't remember his last name, he translates koan as sangha case. Usually it's translated as public case, meaning it's like legal cases that we use as a reference. We say, oh, in this legal case, this is how it went, so this is how we then treat a situation. Koans are cases of examples, stories, poems that reflect or are an example of some aspect of absolute reality. It points to that. Someone in that story has a glimpse of absolute reality, of just the oneness of the world, the non-duality of the universe, oneness of everything. No separation, self and other. These stories are just involved with telling that. And they're enigmatic because they don't make any sense. And we can't understand them with our logic and intellectual discursive mind. So we are asked to just stay with it, let go of thoughts, let go of whatever, just do our sitting practice, let things come and go, just sit here. And the more that we do that, the more that our mind becomes clear, the more that we see that it's just, you know, as, what is this guy's name, David something, says, you know, it's just, we have this first experience of, it's just I with the universe, you know, we're all just here, I and the universe just flowing. There's still I in the universe, though. Then the next step would be I as the universe. So I am the universe, and we're all just flowing. Everything just is. Then eventually we come to this, just the universe. It's not even I as the universe, it's just the universe. But in this initial phase of I and the universe just flowing, we return to that, and it becomes more relaxed and easier then to bring in these enigmatic stories or poems that we call koans. But this example I've just given of this story that makes no sense, of the President of the United States wanting to buy a country, or if the country is not for sale, to use force to take it, okay? And it's a country that is a friend, it's not an enemy, right? If it was an enemy, okay, we can make sense of it, but it's not an enemy, right? I say make sense of it in our dualistic usual logic. We could make sense of it. From the point of view of oneness, even invading an enemy doesn't make any sense because there are no enemies. There is no one to invade. We're all one, okay? But from our traditional usual logic of the dualistic world we live in, Invading an enemy makes sense, but invading a friend doesn't. And hostile takeover in the business world makes sense, but a hostile takeover of a friendly nation, of a country, you know, we don't think of it as a business, you know. We don't think of a nation as being a business. But in the world of capitalism, it is a business, right? So how do we then, how can we even begin to respond to that situation? Because it makes no sense. So we step back, we sit, it's a koan. It doesn't make any sense. And with all koans, you know, koans like, what is the sound of one hand? Doesn't make any sense. That's one of the classic koans, you know. Or what is your true face before your parents were born? Another koan. Or another one, does a dog have Buddha nature? What? So, we just stay with it. We don't jump in and start reacting from an emotional place. Of course, initially we probably do. We're outraged. We think it's absurd. We make jokes about it. We are fearful. Other European countries send armies. Everybody's worried. What's going to happen? Whatever. We become really anxious about it. If we just sit, then even that can, we just sit with the anxiety. We just sit with the emotional reaction. You know, so what are your, you know, like when we were sitting this morning for two periods, it's interesting to like look and say, okay, what emotions was I experiencing during those two periods of sitting? Not only what, you know, was I thinking, or what was happening, the cat wanted to go in, the cat wanted to go out, the cat was meowing, you know, there's a lot of cat going on here. The refrigerator making noise, walking outside in the mud, you know, what emotions, just because that can be really helpful to come back to, what emotionally was I experiencing? And not becoming engaged with them, just what emotions was I experiencing? Anxiety, fear, anger. If we, you know, I'm talking about that koan we're looking at about Greenland, right? And when we see them, we can just let them go. We have to see them first before we can let them go. And usually the hardest things to let go of are those emotions, right? Whether it's anger, whether it's fear, and usually fear and anger are related. Behind the anger, there's very often fear. Anxiety, also fear, you know. So we can just stay with it. Let those emotions come, let them go, just be with them, not try to get rid of them, not try to engage with them, just let them be. And the more we do that, then, the more that there is this opening to not acting. We can more easily just let things be. We can more easily just listen. I often tell the story after 9/11, the day of that day, so it was afternoon here in Europe, it was morning in the United States. I happened to be, and this was really before, you know, there wasn't nearly, at least in France, there wasn't nearly the internet connection and people didn't have cell phones and so much. And we were really not so connected as we were in those days. And I was just happened to be doing at the Donna Zen Center next door, a peacemaker retreat with Bernie Glassman, who was one of my teachers, and you know, a large group of people, some of whom were Americans. And I think it was probably the first or second day of the retreat, and we all just were sitting there all day long. And then I had to leave at 4 o'clock to. Because we were doing this retreat, we weren't connecting to computers, phones, television, nothing, radio, nothing, right? So we didn't know anything. And I had to go pick up my son, who was in nursery school at the time, and so I had to leave at 4 o'clock, and they were going to continue until 6 and then probably have dinner and sit at night at home. So I left, went to pick up my son, no idea, nobody at the nursery school had any idea. Picked up my son, take the bus. I wasn't living here at the time, I was living in Paris. Go to the supermarket, groceries, nothing, right? Nothing. Nobody was, nothing. Get home, and my daughter, who was 14 at the time, opened the door, and she was white, and she was panicked. And she said, "Mommy, it's the start of World War III." Mm-hmm. And she had heard about this at school and was saying, "Yes, they, you know, their airplanes flew into the World Trade Center." And I'm like, this is, you know, this 14-year-old girl thing, you know. This is like the teenagers telling each other stories, you know. I'm like, no, what? I don't think so. You know, really, really, Mommy, really, really. So I kind of started believing her that something weird was going on, you know. So we'd only been in that apartment since September 1st, and we didn't have any television or internet connection at the time. But this was still in the days when you could, you know, use the telephone modem thing where you could connect your computer with the telephone. So I dragged my computer out of the box and I put it there and I connected with the, no, I didn't even think to do that yet. I put on the radio is what I did actually. Put on the radio. And it was the BBC and it was like, what? Unbelievable. So this was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This had happened at like 2 hours earlier. And I think when I turned on the, you know, like the second plane had just hit or something, and the Pentagon plane had crashed, or I don't know. And there were still planes up there and nobody knew where George Bush was. And it was total chaos, right? Unbelievable thing, right? And I could make no sense of it. So, and my daughter was in just like a state of almost hysteria, you know, total fear. And my son had no idea. Really. I mean, he was like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, didn't really know. He was 5 and, you know, he was playing with his cars or dinosaurs or something. And so fortunately, I didn't think to put on the modem and connect to the internet because I'm glad that my kids didn't actually see the pictures. Mm-hmm. I had no, you know, there was no like streaming or anything at that time. So it was just photos like on websites. But even then, I didn't think of that until late at night. But what I did was I couldn't say anything to my daughter. You know, I couldn't really even reassure her because I didn't know either, you know. So I just entered that space of not knowing. And because I had been in this peacemaker retreat, probably that helped. Mm. And I just listened to her. I just listened, just let her speak and welcomed whatever she said, received it as okay. You know, not trying to convince her, don't be scared. You know, like when a child falls down and they hurt themselves, you give them a piece of candy. Don't hurt, don't worry, you're not hurt. You know, don't feel the hurt, don't hurt the pain. So I just listened, just welcomed it, and shared that I too didn't know, and that I too could be afraid, you know, because of that, we don't know, without going into hysterics, I'm scared too, don't be afraid, but just, yes, I hear you, I know, it's frightening, you know, and that seemed to, you know, appease the situation for all of us. And the next day I went back to the, we still didn't really know much, you know, I mean, it was becoming a little more clear. The next day I went back to the peacemaker retreat and they, meanwhile, you know, like somebody had gone out for a coffee and heard at the cafe about it, or no, I think it was the Americans were getting phone calls. The Americans, of course, had cell phones at this point. And I'm sure they had email accounts, but they probably didn't have smartphones. So, in fact, I'm sure they didn't have smartphones. So they were getting calls. So that's how suddenly everyone next door heard about it. And they didn't have a television either, because I had taken the television when I moved out. And so they went to a cafe and spent the evening like watching at a cafe on television. So we came together at that Peacemaker retreat, and really we just, you know, did what we call talking listening circle, and everyone just shared. And what came first of all, what was so important for me was just listening to my daughter. Not trying to act, you know, act from a place of self wanting her, because it's hard when it's your child and they're suffering and they're afraid to not want to stop the suffering. However, I somehow had this wisdom from the Peacemaker retreat in my practice that putting an end to the suffering was not adding to the suffering, and just welcoming it and hearing it and seeing it and receiving it, right? And then when it was my turn to share, I had this, you know, amazing, quite amazing in that situation, of great compassion for the attackers, for the people who planned this attack, got in the airplane, hijacked the airplane, and knowingly flew it into a building, knowing that, you know, thousands of people would die. And great compassion for that, coming from this place of non-separation, where the oneness of all things, and from when we have that experience, we could never do harm. We could not harm the other. And that seeing that when we don't see that, we're suffering. And our suffering is what keeps us from seeing that, to a great extent. And we would not do something like that if we were not suffering. So I could see that the origin of that act, you know, very violent and deluded act, deluded in the sense of not seeing the other, which comes from, and this was also part of what came for me, their suffering came from their experience of not being seen. So they are attacking the ones who didn't see them. So they're attacking this country that took over their country, that exploited them, that, you know, waged wars and, you know, imperialism and all that stuff. So because they have not been seen, they're suffering, and they don't see the other, or they have an idea about the other, and then they therefore hurt the other. So you can see it's like this chain of events, or, you know, like the domino effect that we are all involved in our individual lives, but in our lives with other, with our direct communities, but our communities at large, and our community at large is the universe. So all of this, you know, is related. So that, for me, that 9/11 experience was really seminal for me, in that it helped me then in any situation in the world, and because I was a journalist, I was constantly involved with these situations in the world. You know, and I still have this professional deformation, as we say in French, of, you know, I'm still like a news addict. You know, I can't not pay attention. But this really helped me to engage and respond with it in a different way. To not be caught by emotions, to just stop and treat it as a koan. Really, and because I had a strong koan practice, I could really treat these things as koans. I did the same thing with, you know, 10 years ago when there was the big migrant refugee crisis in Europe. It made no sense to me. Again, if you look at the basic situation where people are suffering so much in their homeland to such an extent that they're willing to leave everything they've ever known, their families, their homes, and at great cost, many lose their lives. Extreme difficulty to go somewhere else where they think that, where they hope that they will be able to live in peace and have a healthy, happy life. So these people leave everything they've ever known at great cost, danger, risk, go somewhere else, and when they arrive somewhere else, they're told, you can't come here. We don't want you. You're not like us. You don't look like us. You don't pray like us. You don't eat like us. You don't speak like us. Go away. This makes no sense. It made no sense to me. In the same way that, you know, buying Greenland makes no sense, you know. So how could, if someone knocks at your door and they're hungry, will you say, no, I don't like the way you look? So it made no sense. So what did I do? As I know with, I had, you know, empty myself, which I'm used to doing, and I have regular practice of that. And then that told me, okay, well, I have to really go into the situation to understand it, not from an intellectual point of view, because from a geopolitical intellectual view, I know. I understand the migrant crisis. I think it's absurd from a oneness point of view, from a oneness experience, but I know that from the geopolitical point of view, that's why it's happening. So I said, well, I have to go into it directly. So I went and I volunteered at a refugee center in Paris so that I could really experience the situation firsthand. Who are these people? How are they being treated? What is being done for them? What is not being done for them? What is this, you know? All I knew was reading it about it in the newspaper. So I went and I did it. And basically what I did was I did laundry all day long. It was a place where people could come, migrants, but men only. There was another place for women and families. So it was only men. They could come during the day, they could charge their phones, they could stay there all day long. They could have coffee, sandwiches, and some of them, depending on where they were in their process, could stay at the center for like between 5 and 10 days while their dossier was being processed. So some people lived there, the others who couldn't live there yet could come during the day and stay. And all of them could bring their laundry and give it to us, and we would do their laundry and a few hours later give it back to them. So basically I just did laundry all day. And which was a great practice because I was serving them. I could interact with them. They all came and brought their laundry and I could talk to them. And I could hear their stories. I could see their clothes. I could see who they were. And at the time, most of them were the same age as my son. My son no longer in nursery school. My son now, you know, he's a college student. They were just like him. They had the same clothes. They looked the same. They listened to the same music. They, you know, talked like him. The ones who could speak English, and many of them spoke very good English. It was, you know, an astounding thing to realize they're just like everyone else. Which I can't say I didn't think they were, but when you have that direct experience, it's very different. And to hear their stories of where they came from, a lot from Afghanistan, Syria. I had no idea what Somalia, Sudan, even like Cameroon, which surprised me, people from Cameroon. And some of them, you know, the Afghans had been on the road for 3 years. They had gone through Germany and then up through Finland and Norway and Denmark and then ended up here, you know, because nobody wanted them, right? So just to hear them, listen to them, be with them. And then at some point, the organizers of the center asked me to teach them meditation. So I said, okay, I'll do it. Even though they were only there for a couple days or only a few hours or something. So I said I would do it. And there was no common language, really. Some could speak English, some could speak French. Many could not speak English or French, and I couldn't speak Arabic or they speak in Dari in Afghanistan, all these languages I couldn't speak, right? But usually in the group there would be someone who could translate for the ones who didn't speak. But basically I couldn't do like this and talk. I had to just give really basic instructions, we were sitting on chairs in a circle, so showing them to sit, put your hands like this, feet on the ground. I would signal, breathing, breathe in, breathe out, one, breathe in, breathe out, two, just basic stuff, right? And this was, we're sitting in this circle of chairs in this huge abandoned warehouse that had been converted into a center with containers, shipping containers. But it was open to the périphérique, and we're sitting there and people are walking by and whatever. Did it for 10 minutes, walked for 10 minutes, did it again for 10 minutes. And that was it. And unbelievable experiences. One in particular, which there were others like this, but one in particular, the guy's face was beaming, right? He just like brilliant, radiant, his eyes were like glossy. And he said, I smiled at him, he smiled back, and he said, oh, we should do this all the time, something. And I said, yes, you can. And I said, what you have just experienced, and this is pretty outrageous that I would say this, but I said to him, what you have just experienced, why it's so beautiful, is because that's home. That's your home.
And he burst into tears.
And I'm saying that, what?
And he burst into tears.
Well, he practically, yeah. Because here I am, if I think logically, right, I would never have said that to this guy who has left everything. He's left his homeland. He has no home. He has no country. So logically, from a point of view of, the everyday world, I would never say that to him. But I was not responding from that place. And he was not speaking from that place either. What he had experienced, why it was so wonderful for him, was because that's what it was. He had come home to himself. And I said, that's your home, and you can find that everywhere, wherever you are. I have no idea what happened to the guy, unfortunately, but I guess why not, And I have no idea what happened to the rest of them. I fear that many, probably not good things happened. So a lot of them, they wanted to go to the UK. So they probably did go to the Normandy coast and maybe died in the channel, or maybe they're living in the UK right now, I don't know. Many maybe got sent back. Many had even, some had even burned their thumb print because there was this recently installed at that time policy, European policy, the Dublin Accords, and they called it, you were going to be, in French, Dublinisé. So wherever you arrived as a refugee, usually it was in Greece or Turkey, those were the first places, your fingerprints were taken, they took your name and country and origin and everything, and then, they put you in a refugee center or something, and then if your papers weren't approved, then you moved on somewhere else, because within Europe you could cross the borders, But then they started the system where they were going to check fingerprints, and wherever you had first been printed, they had to take you in. You had to go back to that country where you had first been printed. Well, of course, Turkey and Greece and Italy did not want this, right? Well, they just sent everybody back. So if you went back to Italy where you had first arrived, you could be sent back to Libya or Syria or wherever you had come from, right? And you didn't want that, right? So these guys actually burned their thumbs so there would be no trace of their fingerprint. In any case, all of this I experienced with these men from a place of non-duality, you know? Of course, I knew I was different than them. And when they heard that I was American origin, they, you know, they were like, what are you doing here? Oh, we want to go to America. And I said, no, you don't. You don't want to go to America. You really don't want to go to America. You really, really don't want to go to America. But all of this came from not, from stepping back from the usual discursive, logical way of thinking and being. Stepping back, reset, factory settings, I don't know, the situation of refugee situation, I don't know. Of course, I had my opinions about it, my ideas about what should be done, and they should do this, and they shouldn't do that, but I don't know. Went there with an open mind and heart. Did I resolve the refugee migrant crisis? No. But I did, I helped someone because their laundry was dirty. I made coffee. I talked, I gave some kids kind of human presence. I gave them a welcome. At least one guy, I introduced him to coming home to himself with meditation, you know? I would never have thought of any of that if I was coming from, I'm going to resolve the migrant crisis, you know? And this is why I say Zen practice is useless, because if you really come back to the the factory settings, take that step back. Let go all of the apps and everything you've put on yourself, and just sit with what is, you will be amazed at who you truly are, how the world truly is, how you can move and act in the world without fear, without anxiety, without anger, without grasping. Of course, like I said to that guy, we can do this any time. The new year is a good moment for it, you know, because we're fresh. We have this new élan, you know, to start something, to return to something. And it doesn't have to be anywhere special, right? So, you know, this is just my living room, and you're just in your homes. You don't have to, like, you know, say, okay, I'm gonna meditate, I'm gonna go to a Zen center, or I'm gonna do this or that, I'm gonna come on the screen and sit every session or something. It doesn't really have to be that. It could, you know, that could be what is will inspire you, you know, to return. However, you know, maybe if you just stay with the initial inspiration, the whatever the solution is will come of itself. So I really will want to return to my true self or something. And you sit down on your cushion and that's what your motivation is. And if that is your motivation, you won't have trouble maintaining that motivation. It's when we start getting these, you know, stuff, obsessive stuff about accumulating or a certain amount of time or hours or wanting to be, you know, arrive at some amazing place. But if we're just in a place of inquiring, of just looking, then anything that arises is okay. It's not, doesn't have to be any big thing. And I read in this from the same guy, the translator, David, I can't remember his name. I've talked about him before, but anyway, I recently did this calligraphy workshop as well with Chinese ideograms, and the ideogram for monastery in Chan or Zen monastery, which basically means place of practice, or what does he say it is? Or no, where meditation takes place. That the pictogram, the ideogram for that, is earth and altar, which is incredible. So it's not like a temple. It's not like a special place. It's not like this magnificent zendo with you know, fabulous statues and stuff. The earth is your altar. And when we started Wildflower and I said that, I didn't know this about this pictogram. I always say, you know, the universe is our zendo and the earth is our altar. Well, I didn't know that, but that's what it is, right? That's the monastery. The earth is the altar. And, you know, if we and we can even, you know, I was going to say, we often say, well, yeah, the earth is sacred, we should take care of it. But as soon as we say sacred, then we say something else is profane, is not sacred. So, and Bodhidharma, our great ancestor, said that, you know, nothing sacred, which means everything is sacred. So if we truly see the earth as our altar, well, then we take care of the earth. And if we truly see that, then we know that wherever we are is the altar, is the place where meditation takes place. So, you know, sitting on chairs in this, you know, decrepit warehouse on the, you know, overlooking the edge of the city, we all had our coats on because it was winter and it was cold and people are walking by. That's the altar. Place where meditation takes place. That's how I could say to that guy, you can be home wherever you are. I even kind of shrink when I say that because I'm saying this to this guy who doesn't have a home. But I might not have said it to someone else in that circle. I could say it to him because I knew he knew it. He had experienced that. And it helped to give him some, put a name on what he had experienced so that he could return to it again, you know. So, beginning of the year, great moment, start fresh, you know, refresh the page, recharge the battery, return to factory settings, be you, be truly you, and then when you walk in the world, when you experience others, because you're truly you, you see they are truly them. And you see what is truly the situation and how to respond. Also, part of that is knowing that all is impermanent. Everything changes. Sometimes we see that, sometimes we don't. Okay, that too changes. Sometimes we are connected with, yes, this is home. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes we're lost. Changes, fluid. And the true freedom is, like we say, dwelling in nowhere, not moving from this moment. So being one with the fluidity. And that everything changes includes the way the world is at this moment. We tend to think of it as being, if we like the way the world is, then we don't even really think about it, we're happy, everything's good. And then as soon as it's not like that anymore, we really want it to be like it was before. But when it was before, it wasn't actually before either. It was just this, but manifesting differently. So even this stuff we don't like, you know, Donald Trump, impermanent. Totally impermanent. I mean, and he is really a super manifestation of impermanence because it's always something else, right? Changing all the time. It's like, you know, flooding the zone. Always something else. That is always something. This too will change. This too will pass. We don't know what that means. We just know that it's not fixed. Like our identity is not fixed. Neither is any situation fixed. It too will change. The actions in that situation will change. The consequences resulting from that action change as well. You know, one of the former traditional Republicans in the United States, Liz Cheney, who was one of the ones who resisted Donald Trump a few years ago, said when she left she was defeated because Trump, you know, had people run against her. When she left her seat, she said to her colleagues, Donald Trump will die, but your dishonor will live on forever. Yes and no. It's true that dishonor is, you know, stuck to their face. That's true. They also will die, those people, but their dishonor is true. Can they be forgiven? Absolutely. How does that look? We don't know. It's also fluid. So even, you know, like the emperor asked Bodhidharma, because the emperor had done all these beautiful things, you know, he was supporting monks and he was building monasteries, and which he really didn't need to do if the earth is the altar, but you know, beautiful artwork and everything. So he's supporting Buddhism. So he says to Bodhidharma, well, what merit is that? He wants it to be useful. He wants Zen to be, or Chan at the time, to be utilitarian, and he wants to gain something from that. And Bodhidharma says, no merit. There's no merit to it. You don't do it because you're going to be rewarded for it. And in the same way, there will be consequences from what you do, you know? So yes, you did this, you built this structure, you've helped people practice, you've, you know, helped, you know, keep the practice alive and the traditions alive, but there's no personal merit for you in that. You might be, people may love you for it, or maybe your kingdom will be attacked by a king who is against Buddhism, so you may suffer from it, but you don't do it for those consequences. And so in the case of those who have dishonored themselves, they were acting from a place of wanting to benefit. And their dishonor is linked to not being true to the wholesome aspect of life or something. So there are consequences from that, but it doesn't mean that those consequences, we don't know what those consequences will be, you know? We don't know. But do we act from a place of wholesomeness or from a place of harm? In either case, we don't do it because it's for personal merit. Because as soon as there's personal merit, then that action is selfful, full of self instead of selfless. Which brings us back to the original settings and reboot at the new year. So I think I will stop now. I don't, can't see the time.
Okay.
So we have a couple of minutes if anyone would like to. Questions, comments, share something. Or not.
Maybe two things that came up as while sitting. While sitting, it felt as when you started talking about emptying yourself. That's what was happening, and it was just feeling the emptiness in order to be full again of all of this. So it's funny that you spoke about it. And then the other thing about reboot, it just makes me think of my mother, who recently had heart issues, and you can reboot the heart also with an electric shock, and it's just amazing. Clean slate, sort of, for some time at least, and it starts again. It's just, it's amazing what rebooting can do. Yeah, that's what I wanted to share. Thank you.
Well, and amazing that this mind, you know, this discursive, cognitive, logical mind can brilliantly put itself to the service of, you know, creating a system that helps people to reboot their heart, rather than creating weapons of mass destruction. I mean, unfortunately, our mind does both, but it's wonderful that there are minds that devote themselves to well-being in this relative world. Fabulous. And that allow someone to reboot their life. Beautiful. Maybe we can stop there. Thank you. And keep returning, sitting, coming back to the original factory settings.
We start again at 2:30.